Blog Talk Radio.
How you doing, everyone? Welcome to another program. It is Saturday, and we're into spring. It's the 18th, and welcome to the program. I like to remind people what Earth Ancients is all about. Quite a few people, especially on the Facebook page, where we have an international audience of about 500,000 people, sometimes confuse us with ancient aliens, and I like to make the distinction ever so often to remind people that Earth Ancients is about known and unknown Earth-based civilizations. Now, we've had a few guests on the past. Many of you remember Mike Barra, who wrote Ancient Aliens on Mars 1 and 2, and has had written quite a bit, and is on Ancient Aliens frequently. Also, Jason Martell, who is the host of Ancient Aliens, has been on the program. But if you remember, the focus of those programs was Earth-based civilizations. And there is a belief among a number of research investigators, including people like Graham Hancock, Mike Barra, Richard Hoagland, and others, that there is a connection between the Cydonian region of Mars and pre-dynastic Egypt. Now, we're not quite sure what that connection is, but that's kind of a fuzzy area. And so that has been an interest of mine for a long, long time. And I have included it in a number of programs. And the takeaway from that is that this is possibly the people who built the pyramids, who built some of the gigantic structures that you can find in Lebanon, the Baalbek ruins, Tiahuanaco, the ruins of South America, some of the massive cities in Central and South America. We're not sure, but as a rule, Earth Ancients is not about aliens, not about UFOs. It's about ancient known and unknown civilizations. So so I just wanted to make that point, because there's a little bit of confusion and people are asking on the page, hey, Why don't you allow pictures of UFOs and a discussion of aliens? Well, I mean, there's thousands of sites that discuss UFOs, and there's thousands of sites that are show aliens and discuss aliens. We're not into that. That's not what we want to focus on. We want to focus on historical accounts of individuals, of civilizations that we do know about, and the remains, artifacts from civilizations we don't know about that we're learning about. Because I think there's a huge gap in history. There's a lot of knowledge that's being hidden away or not revealed. And this is the beauty of books by people like Graham Hancock, Fingerprints of the Gods, which he actually chronicles a variety of ruins that we don't know about, evidence of civilizations that were highly civilized. Some could be as sophisticated as we are today. So just want to make that point. I want to highlight a couple of items that were placed on the Facebook Earth Ancients page. Most notably, we keep getting evidence of artificiality at Bosnia. And I've been posting some fantastic photographs in the last month or so. And a number of engineers and chemists have been out there and are reporting that not only is the structure man-made, but the materials used in the construction of the Bosnian pyramids, the Pyramid of the Sun and the Moon, are off the charts. As an example, a cement has been discovered in the use, and that it was used in a way that's informing the shape of the pyramid. So remember, Bosnia was not really a pyramid that's built from the ground up. Bosnia is unique, and this is why a lot of people believe it's not a true pyramid, but it's kind of changing people's or what you might consider traditionalist ideas around pyramid construction. It's an unconventional pyramid in that the people that built it actually formed and shaped the pyramid using cement blocks and engineering style that is forming a pyramid, not building it from the ground up. And so a number of chemists, like I mentioned, an engineer or two, have reported that these massive cement blocks, some weighing several tons, were placed in a specific pattern to form and shape this pyramid. And this photograph that I have here, it was posted on the 16th of April, it shows evidence of these massive blocks. And we're talking, you know, tens of thousands of these things, well, perhaps millions of these blocks that make this pyramid. So I want to make sure people have a chance to see this. This is a rare series of photographs that were posted. And, you know, Robert Schock has been on the program and basically claims, Dr. Robert Schock, who's a geologist, claims that it's not a pyramid. But I think Schock tends to be more of a traditionalist than a lot of other people, and he feels that because it's not a traditional built pyramid, that it cannot be considered a pyramid. But I think as more excavations are done to this region, I think it's going to be shown that this is a pyramid of an unconventional and unorthodox manner. Now, remember, the estimated age of this site is 50,000 years or more. I think some people have even claimed it's about 100,000 years or more, which kind of makes us wonder, you know, what kind of a society would have built that? What's their focus? What is their history? And to date, we really haven't found, or they haven't really found any specific information related to a civilization that built it. It's just there. There's a few artifacts that have been found, but the work continues. And remember, the excavations are being done by volunteers because the Bosnian government doesn't really recognize this as a true piece of scientific research. And so it's kind of left to volunteers to excavate. So it's kind of a strange situation. But keep an eye on that page. It's always important that we have people look at that, because a lot of the information that's featured on the Facebook pages is preludes to the radio program, the podcast, which is a great way to connect with a lot of the authors and presenters that are on that Facebook page. So don't forget to keep an eye on it. You know, check out Facebook once or twice a week, and then we'll post what the podcast is for the week. Everybody knows the story of Moses. I remember quite as a younger person watching the TV show with Charlton Heston, who plays Moses in the program, and of course Yul Brynner. And you know, it's a fascinating subject. Who was Moses? I mean, was Moses a real person? Was there an exodus of the Hebrews out of Egypt? I mean, these are questions that a lot of people have. And today my guests are two research investigators who have written a book about Moses that I found was fascinating. The book's called Exodus Reality. And Scott Allen Roberts, we've had Scott on before. He wrote The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim, and that was a fascinating talk and look into these beings, be they real or be they mythological beings. And as you remember, Scott is a historian, he's a writer, he is a public speaker, and he studied in Bible College in Theological Seminary for many years, and then left to pursue a career in advertising. Joining Scott today is an archaeologist and Egyptologist, John Richard Ward. John has conducted numerous investigations of ancient Egyptian architecture and symbology, and has explored trade routes of the Western Sierra Desert. It says here Ward was recruited by the Knights Templar of Britannia, who have actively sponsored him to conduct several archaeological and historical surveys and expeditions. But today, we are going to talk about Moses. So welcome, Scott. And John?
I think you forgot to add on John's bio that he is a Knights Templar assassin, and he can kill with his thoughts.
Are you ready? It's coming.
So that's a special technique that you're taught that is kind of like a samurai sword carrier or something? What is that, John?
Well, actually, really, I'm actually a Jedi, but I can't tell you that.
That's right. These aren't. This isn't the Moses you're looking for.
No, these are not the Hebrews you were looking for.
Move along.
I have to ask you guys. One of the most interesting things about this book that I read is, first of all, the most important thing is you guys hail from. Each of you has kind of a different focus. Scotty's kind of a theologian who has this fundamental Christian background, which kind of can bring that up. And here's John, who's a classically trained archaeologist, Egyptologist, anthropologist. How did you guys meet, and how did you decide to choose the subject to write about? Either one can start.
Scotty,
yeah, go ahead.
Should I start how we met?
Sure.
Well, basically, Scotty had run out of money. He was in a drunken stupor at the time. And I had to bail him out in a Singapore strip bar where, unfortunately, he mistook a girly boy, whatever you want to call him. And it was starting to get a little bit embarrassing. And basically, I bailed in to save him and whipped him out of there before he made any further embarrassment about himself. And it was while he was in his drunken stupor that he told me about his lame story that he had about these Hebrews that were leaving Egypt at some point. And he thought that he wanted to tell me about sentiment and so forth. And really, that's how we met. It was about right, isn't it, Scotty?
Well, I think there's a couple of facts there that are off. But
I'm being very quiet. I'm listening. I'm being very quiet here. And our audience is kind of going, okay, what's going on here? But go ahead.
Well, I will have to say that in some kind of adherence to truth, that did not happen in Singapore. So,
Beijing.
And I think there can be some honest truth added to that when I say that I would not have been alone. So anyway, we did forge the beginnings of our relationship through Facebook, of all places. I saw John's site and his postings for the Gebel El Silsila Epigraphic Survey Project. And he can tell you more about that and his other efforts. And we got to talking a few years back. And since he's an archaeologist that lives in Luxor, he's been there damn close to 15 years now, I think. And so I asked him, you know, you're an Egyptologist, you're an archaeologist working and living in Egypt. What's your take on Moses? And we got to talking about that too. And that's really where we forged our friendship. And we ended up a few years later writing the book, which came out about a year and a half ago now, and The Exodus Reality. And we're working on several other projects together. We have we are both run the Paradigm Symposium, which is this October. And we both work on Intrepid Magazine. And we both run Exodus Reality Adventures. We've got a big Ireland tour coming up in June and another Egyptian tour in October. So we keep ourselves pretty busy. And then John's a full-time archaeologist, and along with his wife, Dr. Maria Nilsson, and they have the site of Gebel El Silsila. And John, you're just coming off of your season, and you had a pretty spectacular season, didn't you?
You had an absolute phenomenal season. And I'm actually speaking to you right now for your audience, just to let them know. I'm actually speaking to you from the Nile itself. I'm moored up on our Dahat, which is an old Victoriana sailing boat, which we have as our floating hotel, for want of a better word. We've been here now for 7 weeks. Well, coming up for 8 weeks, actually. And literally, as Philly just said, we're finishing up now. So we leave tomorrow, actually. It's quite a sad day today. But we've had an absolute phenomenal season. So many discoveries here. And it's wonderful. It's been an absolute challenge, but it's been a blessing as well to be here. And we're so grateful for everything that's been provided to us this year by the Egyptian government and the local inspectorate and so forth. And it's been a wonderful year. But yeah, coming to you live from the Nile as we speak.
Love to talk to you sometime about some of your discoveries, John. It sounds the amount of time you've been there, you must have uncovered quite a bit of fascinating information. I can imagine. But this book is fascinating, and what's unique about it, and I'm just going to explain it a little bit to the audience. Each of you takes a different look at the person known as Moses. John takes a look at it from and Hotep, the son of Hapu, and Scott looks at it from another point of view, an individual known as Sensenmut, and discusses it from that point of view. And the book goes back and forth and back and forth between these two perspectives, and really highlights quite a bit of historical data, but also looks at it from the biblical aspect, the actual Bible, and refines the detail that's given in that text through Scott's point of view. Now, the perception that I got was that this is or was an individual, but each of you has a different point of view. I'm surprised that there wasn't some yelling matches at some point about who's right, who's wrong.
Oh, never. Never.
Yeah, I mean, how...
No, Scotty always bowed down and always ended up on bended knees saying, oh, John, I know you're correct.
And
I know you.
You know, while John would give me Scotty, you ignorant slut line, I would just say, you know, what do you know? You just play in the sand. I read books. So
exactly. But with large print and lots of pictures.
Lots of pictures.
Usually they're talking books, though, aren't they?
What's that, John?
They're usually talking books.
I like the talking books. I like the talking books.
Oh, the audio books, yeah.
And it goes bing when it's time to turn the page. Well, John and I really our approaches we end up very close to the same point in time. We're about 80 years apart in our different theories. Same family, same royal house, same dynasty, 18th dynasty, separated by about 80 years. I think your character, the pharaoh, Amenhotep III, would have been the grandson of my pharaoh of the Xs, Amenhotep II. And so we have some similar things that we bring together, but different. We place them differently. I would say that John is more, and we use this to joke around a bit, but he's more of a biblical minimalist. He sees, he can explain it better, but just in a couple of words, he sees the Moses story as more an archetype, where I see the Moses story, I take the Bible and use it as a hinge pin to say, is this reliable history, and can we find history? Can it match up to history? And I think I have. And so we have our two different characters that pursue through the book.
Okay. So, Scott, let's start with you. Why don't you give us just an overview of this individual, Senenmut, and why you feel that he actually could have been the individual known in the Bible as Moses?
Sure. Senenmut, I have focused on this figure in history because of who he is and how he seems to align to the dating system, and the dating system is set forth in the biblical account. There is a keystone verse in the Old Testament in 1 Kings 6:1. It talks about when Solomon, the son of King David, and even though there's dispute over whether or not those characters existed or whether they were biblical mythology, there was a temple won, and as it's called in archaeological terms. And so Solomon, when he's dedicating the construction of this first temple in Jerusalem, with all the arguments and all the different disputes and so on over it, they really come to a median date of about 966 BC for the construction of the Temple One. And this is the temple that eventually was torn down and rebuilt, and then Herod built his great temple, and then the foundations of that are still in Israel and Jerusalem today. It's where the Wailing Wall is, and you see it a lot in the news. So Solomon built his temple, they say, in 966 BC, give or take 3 to 7 years in either direction. Now, in this verse in the Bible, it says it was in the 480th year since the Israelites had left Egypt under bondage and so on, the Exodus, Solomon dedicated this temple, which would be 966 BC. So you end up with a rough date of 1446 BC, thereabouts, if that dating system is to be trusted. Now, what's very interesting is that 480 is 12 40s, and there were 12 sons of Israel, 12 tribes of Israel. 40 was the number of judgment. 12 times 40, 480. Moses lived three segments of 40, 40 years in Egypt, 40 years in Sinai, 40 years after the Exodus. It's to 120. So there's all these 40s in there. And we've got to remember that the Old Testament was recompiled, rewritten 1,000 years after these books would have been written by the rabbis at the Library of Alexandria. And so when you take this dating system, if this is a reliable dating system, you end up in the Egyptian calendar roughly during the reign of Thutmose I, would have been the reign that Moses would have been born into. Amenhotep II, the pharaoh who was the pharaoh of the Exodus in 1446. And if Moses was indeed 80, as the Bible says at the Exodus, you just date backwards and you get 1526 BC as the date of his birth. Now, it says, if you're familiar with the biblical story, that Pharaoh's daughter finds him in a basket on the banks of the Nile, and she sends him back to his mother, and when she's old enough, takes him on as her own. Then it skips all the way up to until Moses is 40 years old. And he murders the Egyptian, runs off. Now, there's I find that the Senenmut character has some great similarities to this character. The dating system seems to line up. The characteristics of this person line up. Senenmut, it said, all we know about his birth, he was born to commoners, it says. Now, knowing the way that the Egyptians recorded things, would they have recorded if he was born to servants or to slaves or to hired hands? Nobody knows for sure. All they say is born to commoners. That's all we know about him. He's raised to great stature by Hatshepsut, who is the daughter of Thutmose I, who would have been, could have been, the royal daughter who found Moses in the Nile when she was 7 to 10 years old. It lines up again. She actually bore the title as a child, Pharaoh's daughter. And when she elevates Senenmut to great status, she grants him 92 different royal titles, amongst them the hereditary prince of Egypt, grand vizier to her court, and so on. And about the time that Senenmut would have been 40-ish, thereabout, he disappears off the Egyptian scene. He's left two unfinished, glorious tombs never used. Hatshepsut dies shortly afterwards. Her stepson takes over as his rightful place as pharaoh. And 40 years later, it's his son that eradicates all the images of Hatshepsut and Senenmut. And that would have been Amenhotep II, who would have been the pharaoh, I think, by my timeline, the pharaoh of the Exodus. And there's some great conjecture, and it's all speculative, based on some of these historical facts, and that's just Senenmut light there, that it's very probably, I was just talking to Dr. Charles Ayling yesterday. He's the chair of history at the University of Northwestern, as well as the president of the Near Middle East Archaeological Society. And he said there's newer evidence even now that Amenhotep II eradicated all the images of Hatshepsut and Senenmut, and that there is some conjecture amongst the biblical archaeologists that Senenmut was indeed Moses come back, or not, I'm sorry, not Senenmut, but that Moses came back. Charles Ayling doesn't plug the name Senenmut onto Moses. He said that might be a little more romantic view. He says it could have been, it's in the same household, the same era. He says that we don't know who he was, but there you go. That's my character. So, Moses.
Okay, so real quickly, before we go to John's version, Senenmut was, the name was changed by Hebrew scholars to Moses.
Hebrew scholars had nothing to do with the changing of Senenmut's name. I'm making a conjecture, a speculation that Senenmut is Moses because the facts seem to match up. And one of the facts about the name change of Senenmut, we don't know what his birth name was according to Egyptian history. In Egyptian history, though, it has Hatshepsut renaming him, giving him the name Senenmut. And according to the biblical account, Moses' mother, a Hebrew slave, according to the Israelite slave, according to the Bible, gave him the name Moses. And then that Pharaoh's daughter says, or Pharaoh's daughter in the Bible called him Moses because she drew him out of the water. According to Egyptian history, whoever Senenmut was, whether he was Moses or not, we don't know. I'm speculating that he is. She renamed him from whatever his birth name was. She gave him the name Senenmut, which in Egyptian means mother's brother. In other words, I, your mother, am elevating you to the status of brother to the gods, equal with me to the gods. Or it could have been a mother of Egypt type of, we're not quite sure. That's probably more accurate to Egyptian history and how they would have done things in light. But she named him Senenmut, which basically meant mother's brother.
Okay. All right. Okay, so John, your version is Amenhotep III, right? So tell us about this individual and why you believe that he is the biblical Moses.
Well, let's clarify that first. When you say the biblical Moses, you're referring to a characterization by Hebrew scholars who just around about 300, 400 BC, 72 of them sat in their own little cells in the Alexandria Museum, which is the Alexandria Library, and recanted or retold the history of their now released captive people. the original Torah, or what we call today the Torah, was rewritten then because it was lost. So you have 72 Hebraic scholars rewriting the history of the Hebrew nation after all the oral traditions. Now, as far as the characterization of the biblical character, one has to first of all look at the facts. Now, Scotty's theory is a very good theory, flawed, but good. And I actually have a lot of time for Scotty's theory. I quite like the romanticism of it all. I don't go in for the romanticism with Amenhotep, son of Hapu, but I do like that. That's where Scotty draws upon that, especially the affair with Queen Hatshepsut and so forth. But going back, what one has to look at, first of all, is the Jewish or the Hebrew nation, the Israelites themselves. And this is one thing that both Scotty and I tend to agree on, and that is that the people who left in the Exodus were not Hebrew. They were not Jewish. They were not Israelites. They were Egyptians. By birth and by culture, they may have had some kind of very loose Hebraic kind of religion that they may have held to, that may have had simpler forms compared to that of the Egyptian cult religions, which they would have been practicing at their time. So one has to bear that in mind when you talk about the exodus of all these thousands of people uprooting and leaving Egypt. They're leaving their homeland. The majority of them would have been born here. The majority of them would have been completely Egyptianized. They would have only known the Egyptian religion. They would have only known the Egyptian language. Very important to bear that in mind. The Hebrew language, the Hebrew culture, the Hebrew religion had not yet been formed. One has to really remember that. Now, as far as my characterization, I like to think that Amenhotep, son of Hapu, who was the grand vizier, the grand architect, the chief steward, the chief architect, etc., 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 etc. He had so many titles, same as Senemut with Scotty. And he was under the reign of Amenhotep III, the pharaoh, who was the father to the heretic king, of course, which we all know and all familiar with, Akhenaten. Now, one has to also remember that with Hapu, similar to Senemut, and all of a sudden he just disappears out of history after, of course, raising his huge monumental temple to himself, his own mortuary temple, unheard of. He wasn't a pharaoh. He was a commoner, for want of a better word. The right hand of the living god, i.e. the pharaoh, but nevertheless a commoner. But he built a temple to himself which dwarfed that of Thutmosis on the west bank of Thebes in Luxor today. He had a splendid tomb, by all accounts, but there is conjecture there. The Spanish mission are currently working on TT-100, if I remember rightly. And that tomb could possibly be the tomb of Amenhotep, son of Hapu. They refer to Amenhotep, son of Hu, H-U-Y. There could be some kind of mispronunciation there or mistranslation, but it was very common for all Amenhoteps to be called Hu, H-U-Y. It was a shorter form, a nickname, for want of a better word, for men who were called Amenhotep. So we've got the basis there. Now, with myself, with my theory, what I talk about really is the historical accounts. What do we have here laying on the ground? What is the evidence that we have? And it's very little. It is very little. One has to put one's hand in the air and say, you know, as you always say to Scotty, and Scotty always says to me, we weren't there, we don't know, and we will never know. But as long as archaeologists like myself keep our trowels in the ground, history will be forever changing. And so with that in mind, the theory that I put forward was one of the lakes of Malkutta. And the lakes of Malkutta is a huge man-made lake in ancient Thebes, which would have broken its banks, flooding and destroying Thebes in the process during the high inundation, the high flooding of the Nile. And for people who are familiar with ancient Thebes and may have even been to Luxor on holiday, who are listening, they probably won't be aware that there's another lake which was on the east bank of the river as well. The Romans referred to it as the Hippodrome, but it was actually an actual lake, another lake. And these two lakes would have broken and flooded the complete area. Now, the complete devastation that would have been the aftermath of this apocalyptic event would have been nonetheless of the apocalypse. You would have had death, destruction, pestilence, famine, disease, everything that we see today. When we see the news and we see the tsunamis, for instance, imagine that in ancient Egypt. There would have been no FEMA. There would have been no emergency responders. There wouldn't have been a national outcry, and you know, the world wouldn't have rallied around and sent aid to them. Helicopters wouldn't have been coming in, dropping parcels of food and warm clothing and so forth. There would have been nothing. They would have lost everything. The disease would have been rampant. And don't forget, the Nile at that time was not a safe place. It was full of crocodiles, hippopotami. It would have been a bloodbath. The feeding frenzy, let alone from the waterborne animals like the crocodiles and so forth, but also from the wolves and the jackals that lived amongst the mountains, the lions, the tigers. Remember, ancient Egypt was a totally different landscape to that which we know today. And so the feeding frenzy by the animal kingdom would have been devastating. There would have been literally rivers of blood pouring down through what was left of the remains of ancient Thebes down into the River Nile. The entire infrastructure would have been destroyed. And when you can kind of, you know, imagine that, all these mud brick houses completely destroyed, bodies mangled against the temple walls, and blood everywhere, body parts, pestilence, disease, flies, no fresh water, no clothing, no wood to burn, nothing. They would have pointed their finger at one man, and that would have been God. In this case, the living God. And that would have been Pharaoh, Amenhotep III. And I believe the people pointed the finger at him and said, "You are to blame." And there would have been a political revolution at that moment. And there would have been a schism, I believe, within the higher elite, the echelons of the higher elite, the aristocracy of ancient Thebes. And it would have been split. You would have had half, for instance, going with Pharaoh, but the other half would have turned to Akhenaten. And Akhenaten, who had been busily building his new city in Amarna, not necessarily a new kingdom or a new capital, but a city to worship the Aten, the god Aten. Now, most people, when they think of Akhenaten, they think of the new god, the Aten. They think, well, it's something that Akhenaten just dreamt up. It had been going on for hundreds of years prior to that. And so I believe that Amarna was actually built for the praising, the worshipping of the Aten. It wasn't built purposely as the new kingdom or the new capital, but merely a place of worship. And it just happened to be coincidental, synchronicity, that it was ready. And he took with him the echelons, the aristocracy, the army, the police, his mother. But there's two characters missing. And that's the sister, Sitamon, and the brother, Thutmosis. And Thutmosis was the real heir to the pharaoh. He was the oldest son, but he's missing. The daughter, Sitamon, married the pharaoh, her father, just prior to this devastation taking place. They're missing. The other person who's peculiarly missing here is Amenhotep, son of Hapu, the great vizier, the great prophecy. Now, he erected a statue within the halls of Karnak, giving thanks for reaching the grand old age of 80 years old, and wished to attain the magical age of 110, which in ancient Egyptian religion was the magical age to reach. He didn't say he died. He just said thanks. Now, these three characters are missing. Now, I hypothesize here that because of the devastation, there's nothing there. There's nothing left in Thebes. It's a complete ruin. Amenhotep III, the pharaoh, who's bedraggled and everybody's pointing the finger at him. He's lost his son, who's a bit of a quack anyway, Akhenaten. Off he goes over to his new Amarna, taking the people with him. he appoints Amenhotep, son of Hapu, as steward to look after his daughter and his son and take them away from Thebes while it's being rebuilt. And he takes them east across the desert. And on his way, he stops, of course, at the Grand Mountain, which both Scotty and I do agree on, and that is Serabit el-Khadim in the Sinai, the Mountain of God, as we refer to, where on top you've got a series of steles and a series of rooms within a kind of, most people refer to it as a temple complex, but it's not a temple. It's just a series of commemorative rooms. Each pharaoh who would send his parties to Serabit el-Khadim to mine for the turquoise, which was very special to the area, would erect a stelae, a tablet, with writing on in hieroglyphic text and a few pictograms to announce this great expedition. And it's there that I believe that Amenhotep, son of Hapu, wrote down what we refer to today as the Ipu Papyri, which is a list of moral guidance, basically, the same as the Ten Commandments. And in fact, it's identical to the Ten Commandments, only longer. And he handed that, came down from the mountain and handed that to the actual king himself, the boy king, Thutmosis, and handed to him and said, now you're in charge of these people. And for me, that's where I stop, because I don't believe there's no need to carry on. There's no need to find Israel. There's no need to find all the other bits, the tabernacle, the cloud of God, and so forth and all that. I just believe that it's worthy of just putting out facts and taking them and looking at them in a different way. But I do believe it's Amenhotep, son of Hapu, because when we come back to the historical side of things, even here on my site today, here at Gebel el-Sosila, we have a couple of shrines attributed to Amenhotep, son of Hapu. And his name has been completely hacked out. One of his shrines has been completely smashed to pieces, as if in a fit of anger, someone has come along and hacked it to pieces and strewn the pieces all over the place. Okay. We've even got a cenotaph here dedicated to Senemut.
Yes, and the Senemut cenotaph has also been completely defaced.
Yes.
And we believe, as I mentioned earlier, that when Amenhotep II, the pharaoh who I believe was the pharaoh of the Exodus before John's, that he went about defacing all of Hatshepsut's temples, all of her images, everything, and that he also took to destroying everything known about Senenmut at the time. And I believe it's because Senenmut returned as the Moses of the Bible, retaking that name. But there's something very interesting here is that in both John's and my stories, you've got reaction. No matter which one of these men was Moses, these men had something to do that led that led people who came afterwards to destroy their images, to try to eradicate them. And there's a big question that looms out there that John and I didn't deal with necessarily in our book, and we've talked about it a little bit, and that is this notion that the Exodus maybe wasn't a singular event. It maybe happened.
New evidence come to light this season at Gebel el-Sosila. Mm-hmm. I can't say any more. I wish I could, but I can't. Scotty and I are in discussion whether we should do Exodus Reality Revisited.
Yes.
Because we have made an enormous discovery this season, which I cannot tell you even anything about, I'm afraid.
And by the way, don't feel left out on that. John does that to me all the time. He'll call me on Skype from Silsila on his boat. After the day is over, he's 7 hours ahead of me here, and so he'll call me what would be about 9 in the evening for him, 2 in the afternoon for me, and he looks knackered, you know, full of dirt and dust and his hair sticking up all over, and he goes, Scotty, we made the most amazing discovery today. And I said, what is it? He goes, I can't tell you.
I love that. I love that John's right there in the heart of it all. And
he is.
Just digging, and that's just fascinating. I want to cover a couple of areas, and these are chapters that each of you have written that are important historically to a lot of people. And let's start with you, Scott. You have a chapter called "Were the Hebrew Slaves Even Really Hebrew Slaves?" Can you talk a little bit about that? Because as John has said, that these may have not been Hebrews because the Judaism had not been started yet, that these were actually Egyptians, then that would make sense. that they maybe were not slaves. So what? Tell us a little bit about that chapter.
Sure. Well, first of all, the word Hebrew is what appears in the text at times. But remember, that was rewritten 1,000 years after the event. These would not have been Hebrews. These would have been, if they were there, truly there, they were Israelites. They were people that were of the family clan of Israel, a man named Israel or Jacob in the Bible. Now, it's not far-fetched to say that they were there, and there are a lot of people who discount it simply because it's a biblical story, and it's wrapped up in a book of faith. But keep in mind, during the time of the Exodus, prior to the time of the Exodus, for about 800 years, people had been filtering into Egypt, into the Nile Delta region, from the Sinaitic region, from the Canaanite region, from the Syrian region, Mesopotamia, and they had been filtering into the Delta during times of famine, during times of just where they needed to move their flocks in, migration, and the Nile Delta was a very fertile region of northern Egypt. And so they would filter in there, and the Egyptians referred to them all as Asiatics. The Asiatics would come begging water, begging fertile grazing land, and so on. And I think the tribe of Israel, the clan, it was a family, they said, of about 70 people that initially had moved into Egypt, according to the biblical story. And that's all connected with the biblical patriarch Joseph. And we all know the story of Joseph and the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat and where that all went. And so they establish a presence to the north and the east of what is present-day Cairo, which about 30 miles or so, John, is that right? When we drove down there, about 30 miles south is Memphis, which yeah. would have been the northern capital. Now, this, I believe that the Israelites migrated from the land of Canaan as a Bedouin tribe, a family tribe. They migrated during what I believe was the Hyksos period. And there's a couple of clues that you get in the biblical text. When Joseph is sold into slavery by his brothers, and then 20 years later, through all this time, he's elevated and makes friends with the Pharaoh. The Pharaoh elevates him to the Grand Vizier and so on. And then his brothers show up one day, not recognizing him, as the biblical story goes, asking for grazing rights and to settle in the land of Goshen, which is up in the Nile Delta there. And Joseph recognizes them, of course. We know the story there. But the question came to my mind was, how did Joseph, a son of a Bedouin clan chieftain, end up becoming the Grand Vizier when he was sold into slavery? And how did that family end up settling there? And then why would they have been forced into slavery? Those were all questions I had. And very simply, I think it plugs into the Hyksos period, because the Hyksos, remember I said for about 800 years, all these peoples from that region, the Middle Eastern region, had been migrating in. And the Egyptians began to ended up referring to them as the Hyksos, which had been translated originally as the shepherding kings or the kings from foreign lands, is, I think, a more accurate translation of that. But what had happened is all these people migrating in got infiltrated sounds nasty and dirty. I think they just became part of the culture where they were living. They integrated, and they eventually, I believe it wasn't by war or by the sword, they took over the governing seat of northern Egypt, and they established their own pharaonic throne. And for 110 years, the Hyksos, the shepherding kings from foreign lands, became the kings of the north of a divided Egypt. And you had the Egyptian rulers, the true Egyptian rulers, ruling from the south in Thebes, which is now Luxor, and about 450, 500 miles to the south. Now, during this period, if this was indeed a Hyksos king that Joseph encountered, I believe Joseph was given the power that he was given because they were actually of the same bloodlines. They were from the Canaanite region. And then there's a key verse in the Old Testament. Now, remember, this is just from an Old Testament story. We don't even know if the story is true, but this lends some plausible credence to the story, is that Joseph, when he and his brothers come begging land, he makes friends with his brothers again. He says, now, when you go into Pharaoh and ask for this land, he said, tell them that you are shepherds and you have been shepherds from the days of your birth, because the Egyptians hate shepherds. And I thought, now, why would he be telling him to tell the Pharaoh that we're shepherds when the Egyptians hate shepherds? I think it's because, and it's unstated in the biblical passage, I think it's circumstantial and speculative to say that it's very possible he was dealing with a Hyksos king, which would have been one of the shepherding kings from that same region. And so they all settled there. And so I believe that when they were slapped into slavery, it wasn't because they were Jews or they were Israelites or whatever. What it was I'm trying to think of the dates. It was in the late, if you look at it backwards, the late 1500s BC, is that Amos the First ousted the last remnant of the Hyksos. He waged war on them. He pushed them out of Menifer, which is Memphis, pushed them out of the Delta region, reclaimed the northern throne, reunited the kingdom of Egypt, reestablished a throne at Memphis, and cleansed the land of the Hyksos. And then he slapped into bondage or harsh labor or put them under some kind of control any remnants of the people who were there. It was like, your option was you flee, you die, or you're working for us. And it was an idea, I think, of not being cruel or anything like that. It was a pharaonic responsibility to his nation and to his people to protect his people. In other words, keep your enemies close, your friends close, and your enemies closer. I think they just put him into bondage and put him into harsh labor. The biblical story, all it says is after Joseph died and all his brothers died and a generation passed, it says a new pharaoh came to the throne who had no regard for Joseph. And this pharaoh said, these Hebrews or these Israelites have grown too numerous. Let's put them into bondage, put harsh bondage over, lest they, and this is what people miss in that passage, lest they rejoin our enemies and retake our nation from us. And I believe Amos was the Pharaoh who did this. He slapped them into bondage to prevent them from joining these Hyksos kings and somehow retaking that northern throne. And it was very fresh in his memory because he's the one who kicked him out. So I think he's supposing. So that's where I think the Israelites came into bondage in Egypt.
Okay. Now, John, you have already stated that you believe that they weren't Hebrews, they were actually Egyptians. Now, have you found evidence in terms of writings or monuments to this fact?
Well, no, because there isn't. That's the beauty of this. In essence, there is no evidence. There's circumstantial evidence when you base it upon biblical scripture. I mean, the new film, Scotty's just done an excellent review of this, by the way, of the new Exodus movie. And again, they've gone down the old route of dragging up Ramesses. We have a few archaeological remains in the north of Egypt which can be attributed to the remnants of the Canaanite region and the way in which they built their housing. That smacks in the face that, oh, possibly they were Canaanites. Yeah, this is where they lived and da-da-da-da-da. When we come down to the Hebraic language, well, of course, there's no monuments in Egypt with Hebraic on it, you know, during the 18th or even the 19th dynasty. It doesn't exist. Again, that doesn't support... It doesn't support my theory, but it doesn't even support the other theory either, that they were Hebrews. It just says there's no archaeological evidence. We've got to be very careful when we put forward our theories, and that's exactly what they are. You've got to remember that. They are theories. They are speculative theories based loosely on archaeological evidence that we have at hand. And one has to remember that fact, because you can't just go out and say, well, oh, you know, the Hebrews, well, they didn't exist because they were Egyptians. Well, I'd like to say that, but I can't stand by that and say 100% that's what that's the truth.
If I can add one thought to this, I don't want to butt into your time here, John, but just one thing that I would add is that I think if they were indeed truly Israelite, they were thoroughly, after hundreds of years of bondage, they were thoroughly Egyptianized, if not integrated fully with the Egyptians.
Exactly.
One of the things I like to draw upon there, if I may, is, again, referring to the mountain of God at Serabit El Khidim. Now, we all know the story of Moses climbing the mountain and sitting up there and having a good old chin wag with God, while his brother Aaron sits at the bottom and has a wrangle with the ragtail band of Exodus people. And they ask him, well, you know, Moses is up there having a word with old God up there. What are we meant to do down here? And they're twiddling their thumbs kind of thing. And they get a bit wrangled now. They're losing their patience. And so they ask Aaron to fashion for them a god so that he can worship this god and give thanks to this god for leaving the bondage of Egypt. And what does he fashion? A golden calf. Well, a golden calf, if you know your Egyptological history, of course, refers to Hathor, the cow goddess. Synchronicity plays its part here because Serabit el-Khadim has two small shrines. One shrine is to Hathor, the cow goddess, and the other shrine is to Ptah, the god of craftsmen, the god himself. And so when we look at the golden calf, was Aaron referring to Hathor? I think synchronicity does play its part here. And so, again, I go back to the fact because he fashioned a calf because that's what he knew. That's what the Egyptians knew who were there. They weren't Hebrews. They weren't Israelites. They weren't following some Judaic religion. They were following the Egyptian religion that they had followed for hundreds of years. Generations of their families had followed the Egyptian religion. Quite possibly at the same time, while adhering to some oral tradition handed down from grandfather to grandfather of some long-lost tribe that came out from the Canaanite, but they were Egyptian. And so the golden calf for them represented Hathor. It represented sustenance. It represented the tears of the desert. It represented the whole genre of being out there. And, of course, the temple of Serabit el-Khadin. It was a temple to Hathor.
And so keep in mind here, and I've got to say, right in line with what John's saying, if you throw the biblical account aligning to what John's saying, remember in this biblical account, they came out from Egypt and all the trouble it says that Moses had wrangling these people. They were happy to not be slaves, but they go out into the desert with him. And when he's at the holy mountain of Sinai, which John said we both believe was Serabit el-Khadim, they're down there, and they come to Aaron, and they say, in the biblical text, they say, where is this man Moses? He's been up in the mountain. Build us a god. In the vernacular of the Hebrew written in that text, they're basically saying this, where's this guy? This guy Moses, this guy that just led us out, he's up in the mountain, he's been gone. And they said to Aaron, build us a god. And he builds them, as John just said, Hathor. Why? They're at Hathor's mountain. They're thoroughly, if they are Israelite blood, they are thoroughly Egyptian. And as I had said earlier, what Moses did for these people, Jewish religion did not exist before this. Moses was the first one to codify Jewish religion. And if you look at the laws, as John mentioned, the admonitions of an Egyptian sage, if you look at that, the law, the tabernacle, the Ark of the Covenant, everything was all very Egyptian in its crafting. And so I think you've got to look at these people in a different way. They may have been Israelite by blood, but if they grew from 70 people to, what does the Bible say, the estimated 2 million people, I think it's probably a skewed number there. But if they had even 100,000 of them there, are they all pure Israelite blood, or are they a mixture of Israelite and Egyptian? That's the big question. Is it John's getting?
Can I just make a point here, and it's quite pertinent, actually, to what Scotty's just said. You know, if you take those kind of figures anywhere, I mean, first of all, I don't know if your audience can picture or can imagine or has been to a gathering where there is 100,000 people, let alone 2 million people. Now, just for a second, can you imagine how much water 2 million people will consume in one day in the arid deserts of Egypt?
Yeah.
Where are they going to get that water from? How are they going to carry that water? How does 2 million people not leave a trace behind?
I think they thought of that, John, when they wrote it down, because Moses struck the rock and that's where they got their water. It was a miracle.
And then if you go to the Temple of Hathor in the mountain, and it's got a natural spring coming from it.
It certainly does.
Right.
So yeah. There again, and again, this we refer to the trade routes. If you look at the trade routes, these guys would have, and Hapu would have known this. The army sergeants, the generals, just the general soldiers themselves who would have been with Hapu, they would have known where the actual water holes were. They would have followed the trade route. Hapu would have known the trade route off the back of his hand. The guy was in his 80s. He was the chief steward of architecture. He knew Egypt like the back of his hand. He would have known where to go, how to gather water, and how to feed and water his people. But when it comes to 100,000 people, 2 million people, those figures are absurd. They are completely absurd. You're talking about a few thousand people, if that. And I say that because if you go into any desert terrain and you look at the tracks, you follow the pathways of the ancient people, and Scotty's seen them firsthand. I've taken him into the mountains, I've taken him into the desert, and we've both seen it with our own eyes. Imagine what 2 million people would leave behind when walking through a desert terrain. It wouldn't be a little pathway. It would be a huge highway would be cut through the desert, and it would still be there today. It's not there. It's missed from the
archaeology. So that raises a lot of questions.
Yeah. We got a little time left, and I want to talk about the actual Exodus. And as we all know, in the movie, after pestilence and a bunch of horrible events befall the Egyptians, Moses leads his people out and begins this big walk. Now, John brought up something in the very beginning of this program that was quite wonderful, and he describes what, to my mind, is the results of a tsunami. And in the book, Victims of Circumstance, John actually goes and describes what must have been something close to a tsunami, because it left the Egypt in ruins. So I want you to expand a little bit on this, John, the results of this great flood, and then we'll have Scott present his point of view, and then I think that'll probably be about it. But can you expand a little bit on what would be a true trigger point to get the hell out of this place, because it's just falling apart?
Well, actually, it's really fascinating, because, I mean, if you go back, say, even 50 years, we wouldn't have the information to hand that we have today. And, of course, I refer to NASA and NOAA, N-A-O-O-A, I think it is, and I refer to the solar flare activity and the research that's coming out with regard to solar flare activity and its effect upon our climate, its effect upon migratory species, such as birds, locusts. I also refer to, when it comes to climate change, the solar flare activity and how that affects the precipitation, rainfall. And one looks, when I talk about the two lakes breaking, I was able to look back, and at the same time that I was trying to put this whole idea together, this theory together, Akhenaten was erecting his boundary steles at Amarna, and he was referring to the solar eclipses that were taking place. Now, I was able to verify that via NASA and their records, and there were solar eclipses. But at the same time, we were in a solar maximum. Now, Dr. Robert Schock has also done similar research on solar flare activity and its effect upon climate change and so forth, and seismic. And also, I look into the way in which solar flare activity is actually affecting us on a personal level, on our own consciousness and subconsciousness. But that's a whole different story. But for me, it was the catalyst, the trigger was the solar flare activity, which triggered a heavy rainfall in Ethiopia. That raised the flood level of the Nile. The embankments of the lakes of Malkata on the west bank and the lake on the east bank just could not hold up to the high inundation, the high floodwaters, and they just gave way. Remember, they were made of mud, and it was actually Hapu who actually made them. Don't forget that. He was the great architect at the time for Amenhotep the Third. And it's very well documented about these lakes, especially Queen Tai, his wife, who sailed upon Lake Malkata on the gleaming Aten barge. And we've got some scarabs which attest to this. Now, when those lakes gave way, the devastation, as I've already discussed, is nothing short of biblical, excuse the pun. But what I refer to, I go back to this, if your audience would care to do this, is do look at the solar flare activity. Do a bit of research. Look at the solar flare activity and see its effects, especially today, on climate change and migratory species. There was a wonderful paper that came out, which I think I mentioned in the book as well, on the migration of locusts from India. And the professor who wrote this paper actually commented on solar flare activity and how the locusts changed their direction at the time. And so we see that not only do we have this huge cataclysmic event taking place where the lakes are breaking, we've got this kind of tsunami, as you refer to, taking place within ancient Thebes, wiping it clean like the hand of God. But we've also got the locusts coming because of the solar flare. We've got high temperature. We've got everything's there that leads up to this massive cataclysmic event, which 1,000 years later is portrayed as the plagues. It's quite easy for me.
Mm-hmm. You know what's really interesting? I just looked it up just now as John was talking. If you go to Google Earth and just Google Luxor, Egypt, and you get out there at an elevation of about, it says right here, 260 feet. I think it's more than that from what I'm looking at here. But you can actually see the remains of Lake Malkata, one of these lakes that John is talking about that broke. It's right on the fertile green edge. If you look at the heart of Luxor on Google Earth, and you just go northwest, almost in a straight line, out to the desert line, you're going to hit this big lake. And there are villages built up on all sides of this lake except the desert side.
Yeah,
and you can actually see the lake itself. You can see the old structure. John and I were down in there, and we got through some backyards or back courts of some of these little village houses, and you can get right up to the walls of this old lake. And it's all fertile land in there now. And the ruins of the palace. And, John, what was it, all those mounds that you and I were walking along last year on the desert side, that was actually the you were saying that was the location of the houses of the nobles.
Yeah, I mean, that stretch that we walked across out in the desert, the Western Sahara Desert on the edge of Luxor or Thebes.
And you can see that on this map.
Yeah.
You can see those mounds.
Yes. That was the massive embankment enclosure and the canal system that fed. And you've got to hand it to these boys. They really knew how to control water, the rise and fall of water, to feed this massive lake. I mean, it held millions of gallons of water. And this canal system fed it. These houses were built on top of it and around it. You had the palace, the great palace of Amenhotep III, laying out, and its remains are there today. And
you can see it on Google Earth.
Absolutely phenomenal. Now, Princeton University, funny enough, had just finished an excavation there last year, and they commented on the rooms that were found. Now, the rooms were built for what they believed dignitaries during the said festival, which I comment on within the book. And when they cleaned them, they found the floors to be completely and totally, what we use the word, sterile in archaeological terms. And what we mean by that is there wasn't even a fiber on the plaster floor. The plaster floor was so clean and preserved, near enough, 4,000 years later, it was unreal. Not even a seed. Not a bead, not even a shard of pottery, nothing. It was sterile. And there was conjecture from Princeton University, whether these series of rooms, and they number in their hundreds for the dignitaries that would have attended the said festival, Ramanujan Chapter 3rd, they actually can gesture whether these rooms were actually used by the dignitaries. And as I wrote in the book, and I'm sure you remember, where I said that the dignitaries fled Thebes after the devastation, and hence the reason why the rooms weren't used. I kind of used that in a tongue and twist to say that, you know, they fled ancient Thebes, which was now in devastation, and they didn't use the rooms itself.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, I just want to comment. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to state that real quickly as a follow-up to what that John just said. It seems that the city was evacuated. Is that the sense that you get? Is that the city was evacuated, and because it was just uninhabitable, or was there a quantity of citizens that were actually stayed there?
What I put forward in my theory is that you've got to remember we can't. Sometimes we've got to step out of our own modern box and put mm-hmm. yourself into the feet of the sandals of the ancient Egyptians. And if you put yourself into those sandals for 1 minute and you put yourself in ancient Thebes on the banks of the River Nile, everything around you is completely and totally destroyed. There is nothing, not even clean water, not even a scrap of bread. The mills are gone. The water's gone. The grain stores have gone. There's nothing to eat. There's nothing to sleep on. There's no shelter from the sun. There is nothing. But at the same time, you've got this political revolution going on between father and son. I believe there were factions taking place. And there was parts that went off with Akhenaten. There were factions that stayed with Amenhotep III. And there were factions that went with Amenhotep, son of Hapu. And there were factions that went off towards Dendera and Abydos in the north. And factions that went south towards Aswan, towards Edfu and Komombo and Silsila and so forth, where I am today, speaking to you live. And these people just literally migrated out of Thebes because there was nothing there. But the palace was there. Now, palace, though, would not have been open to the common man. So you had the higher echelons of the aristocracy who are loyal to the pharaoh, loyal to the king, loyal to the living personification of God. They would have stayed there with him, and then you would have had the ones who are loyal to the new king, Akhenaten, the new god, the Aten. By the way, which was originated, I had to look this up while Scotty was talking, just to make sure my record's correct, that originated during the reign of Amos the First, which Scotty was referring to earlier with Joseph. So forth. So that shows you how long the Aten god had actually been worshipped for. It wasn't a new thing that just sprung up, which most people believe it was.
The perspective is amazing. Scott, why don't you give us your version of the Exodus and what you feel is John's strong points on your perspective, and maybe what your spin is, if it's radically different.
Well, my view of the Exodus is one where I didn't dig too deeply into it into the book, because I just leave that sit as it is. If there was a series of plagues that were instituted or that were incorporated that were either natural events, or if you are a believer in these things, they were miracles of God. There are documentations from the time period that seem to indicate that these things happened. You've got the John speaks of the admonitions. We both have talked about the Apuar papyrus, and there is some there's some confusion over the or dispute over the Apuar papyrus, whether or not it was older and it was an old poem that was appropriated and whatever it was, but it dates back right around 1500 BC, and I place the Exodus right around 1446 BC. So within that 50-year period, when you're going back that far, are you close? We don't know for sure. But my belief about the Exodus is that it took place. If it took place at all like the biblical account, it was just simply that. There was a series of devastations that ended with, and there's no proof for them other than scant little bits, as I've just mentioned, But it took place, and the Hebrews, the Israelites, beat tracks and got out. I have a theory, and John, you and I have only discussed this once or twice, without not too seriously, but I wondered about this. Now, this is more about the person who, if the Exodus took place under Amenhotep II, it's very interesting. In the first 5 years of his reign, he had four or five different very successful military campaigns. Now, in the first 2 years of his reign, he was still co-regent with his elderly father, Thutmose III. And he did all this military campaigning during this time. But if the Exodus took place when the biblical account says it did, it would have fallen within the first 5 or 6 years of his reign. And this is when Senenmutor Moses would have come back to Egypt and pled on the case of his people, let my people go. And many of these people going, who are you? And so he leads these people out. What I find interesting is this, and here's my theory, and John, I don't know if you remember me even talking about this. I said, what if Pharaoh wasn't the guy that Moses encountered at all? What if it was the Grand Vizier? Because remember, the Grand Vizier was Pharaoh in the place of Pharaoh, meaning if Pharaoh is gone military campaign, who's running the government? Well, the Grand Vizier. He was Pharaoh in the absence of Pharaoh and had that much power. And so it's interesting in this whole plague sequence that you see in the biblical passage, when it's all done, the Pharaoh is said to have said, get out, just go, we're done. And they all take off, and Moses had told all those people, be ready to go, have your bags packed. In other words, the engine running. And they take off. And it's very interesting that after that happens, it says Pharaoh again, and there's no differentiation made in the book of Exodus. It doesn't differentiate between any pharaohs. But he says, he asks the question, where are my slaves? And you get almost the keen impression that the pharaoh himself had no idea what took place. And he comes back from perhaps military camp. Now, mind you, this is all speculation. It's a theory that I haven't worked through, and I'd have to really look into this some more. But he, by that question alone, it says to me, was this guy even aware of what happened? And he returns from military campaign, and what happened to my slaves? And he's told the story by who would have been his grand vizier, the elderly now, Rechmir, who is the and John and I have been down in his tomb, and he's got paintings on his wall of Egyptian and Semitic or Asiatic slaves making mud brick and doing all the stuff. And John and I have been down in there. And so if Rechmir was the guy, he would have been the guy that would have been the grand vizier for a few years into the reign of Amenhotep II. And you've got the very possible scenario that Moses met with the grand vizier face to face. And if this was indeed the guy he met with, here's the highly speculative. This is somebody he would have been a contemporary with when he was younger in Egypt.
I wish I could come out with the discovery that we've made this season. It's such a point.
I know.
That's trouble.
I wish I could come out and say that now, but I can't even say it. I wish I could.
I'm gonna have to get a hold of your Facebook page, John, because I'm hoping you're publishing.
It will be all over the news in the next coming months. Trust me, it will be all over. That's how big it is.
Wow.
That's fantastic.
Well, hey, both of you, thank you, John and Scott, for joining me today. The book is Exodus Reality, and it is a real eye-opener for me. It came out about a year ago, but I just discovered the digital version is now available or may have been available on Amazon.
I'm going to tell you this about the digital version. The book
is
a beautiful book. It's got about 70 black and white photos from our expedition. Plus, it's got 16 full color spreads in that book, or 8 full color spreads, 16 pages of color. And those color pages come up as snapshots on the digital version. You don't see the beautiful layout of the book. So if you want to get the book in digital format, you can see it. Yeah, you can get an idea of what the pictures look like, but you're going to miss the gorgeous layout of the book. So I would say if you've got the I think they sell it for like $14. It's $20 retail, but you can get it for like 14 smacks at Amazon.com. You can pick that up and get the hard. I would say get the it's a soft cover book, but I'd get the hard copy as opposed to the digital.
Well, thank you for that, because the digital version was very brief, and there were just a couple of photographs in there of both of you in various parts
of
Egypt.
You're going to miss 70 black and white photos and 16 full color pages of photos if you buy the digital version.
Okay, very good. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what's coming up now? Are you guys going to be doing a tour in Egypt this coming fall, or why don't you give us a little update on where people can get information about your tours and some of the stuff you're doing?
Sure.
Quickly.
Well, the big one that we've got coming up right now, it's 2 months from now. We're taking a tour to Ireland, John and I, and we're also bringing along Micah Hanks and Barry Fitzgerald from Ghost Hunters International and James Swagger, another Irishman. We're doing a trip called the Ancient Megaliths and Sacred Places of Ireland. It's a 10-day tour. You can go to our website, John's on my website, ExodusReality.com. It's the same as the book title, ExodusReality.com. And you can click on the Ireland tour and see the itinerary, all the things we're going to be seeing. The very interesting thing about this trip, we're going to see all these ancient sites in Ireland. We're also going to, Barry Fitzgerald is going to be leading us on a ghost investigation of Leap Castle. And so you're going to want to come along on this. We've only got 15 total seats. We've got a few left open. So if you want to come on this trip, I'd say go over and take a look at this website now. We may be doing an Egyptian trip in October. We're not quite sure yet. John, we haven't decided. We had an Egyptian trip that we canceled because a lot of people that were coming on the trip were a little scared off by some of the events taking place with ISIS and so on. But John's been there now for, what, 7-8 weeks, and he said it's safe there.
It's absolutely, there's no trouble here at all. It's absolutely safe as hell. In fact, I believe Graham Hancock's here this week, along with Zawi Hawass on his grand tour of Egypt. And they should have actually been sailing past me sometime this week, actually, on their Nile cruise. So, I mean, it just goes to show that, you know, business as usual in Egypt. Yes, there's stuff going on. There's stuff going on in the Middle East. There's always stuff going on in the Middle East. It's never going to stop. But Egypt is open arms, and the people are so welcoming.
If I quote Zawi Hawass, Egypt is safe. So, I saw a video of him. And so we do have a trip that's on, on the website if you want to take a look at it. It's over at ExodusReality.com for October, I think, 13th through the 27th.
Yep.
Okay,
after
fantastic.
The Paradigm Symposium. Which, if all your audience out there, if you haven't heard of the Paradigm Symposium, go to the website, ParadigmSymposium.com. And if you haven't bought a ticket to go to the symposium, buy one!
Get it now! Go take a look at it.
Now, where's the symposium in the States? What state is it in?
It's going to be in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where it's been for the last 3 years. And it's this year it's at the Crowne Plaza Hotel, the Mall of America. It's 5 minutes from the International Airport, 5 minutes from the Mall of America, and it's all self-contained. We've got 16 or 17 speakers this year, including Travis Walton, Randall Carlson. Just go over to our website. You're going to see who all is speaking, ParadigmSymposium.com. Get your tickets now and get your hotel room now.
And we've had the likes of Robert Schock with us, John Anthony West, Graham Hancock, Eric von Daniken, Georgios
Philip Coppins.
Philip Coppins. All of the greats have been with us, and this year it's going to be a phenomenal symposium. So
fantastic.
Get your tickets.
John, we want to hear more about your discoveries. Guess what I found, and then not say anything about it. You have to tell us.
Well, if I can do a selfish plug here, we are launching the Friends of Silsila this year, hopefully within the next couple of weeks, in fact, because we're crying out for funds out here. And so the Friends of Silsila, we are launching it this year, so hopefully people will be able to just go to friendsofsilsila.org, if I'm correct, Scotty.
It's going to be friendsofsilsila.com, I think. We might have done a .org on that. We haven't built the site yet, but we procured it. You can go to Friends of Silsila, S-I-L-S-I-L-A, friendsofsilsila.com or .org. I've got to look it up and find out. There's nothing there yet.
Just go along and look us up and try and support us. We're also looking for volunteers. This year was our first year where we actually had volunteers from the general public, non-academics, who come on site and work side by side with us on site and are part and parcel of these huge, massive, great discoveries. You know, you can apply. You have to apply 1 year in advance because of the security issues and so forth and the red tape that we need to go through. But you can apply. Send in your applications. Email us. Send us your CVs. We're not discriminatory. You know, you do not need to have a university degree or be a doctor or have experience. The boat is here. We're looking for volunteers to help make coffee every day and carry bundles of sand from here to there and everywhere. And jump into the scorpion-infested pits and get rid of the snakes for us because, you know, the volunteers are there. They're volunteers. You know, we all have to make sacrifices, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And so we send the volunteers in. We have a little saying, send the volunteer in first. She's dispensable. that's what we do first, really. But no, seriously, look us up. Just Google Gebel El Silsila. That's G-E-B-E-L-E-L-S-I-L. S-I-L-A, Gebel El Silsila. And if you can't find it, look me up on Facebook. Just post it up and you'll find our blog. We keep everybody updated with what's going on here. And again, Friends of Silsila and so forth and all of our publications. And we've got publications coming out everywhere. So we actually do believe here wholeheartedly. It's one of the ethos that we live by. And that is that we don't hold on to the information. We believe that as soon as the information comes out, as soon as we are allowed to, of course, the rules and regulations that we have to abide by, we get it published and we get it out there into public domain because we believe in sharing the information. And through sharing knowledge, everybody benefits.
And by the way, I just looked it up. It is friendsofsilsila.com. We will probably also have .org wrapped up as well. So.
Okay. I want to ask, Scott, if you could send me a few photographs, these rich photographs from your book. What I want to do is I'm going to post a special section for our listening audience to go to Earth Ancients Facebook, and I'm going to have a special section on this program today, which was presented by Scott Roberts and John Ward. On Exodus Reality and some of the book's photographs that are discussed in this program. So a few photographs and then a link to Amazon and then as well as a link right to Exodus Reality. Thank you both. It's been a fantastic hour, and I look forward to hearing great things from you both again real soon.
Well, thank you. I hope to be as famous as John someday.
You wish. You wish.
I keep wishing.
Okay. Great.
Thanks, Cliff.
Thank you both.
Thank you, Cliff.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. That's our program for today. I do want to remind everyone that next Saturday, Dr. John Brandenburg is on the program, and his fantastic book, Life and Death on Mars, which was just discussed in a number of publications, including CNN, because remember, he is a plasma physicist and he has evidence, corroborating evidence, that there were nuclear explosions on the face of Mars. And he believes that this was the result of a number of ancient civilizations at war. And when we say ancient, we're talking approximately a million years ago. So next week, Dr. John Brandenburg's, I hope you'll stay tuned. Have a great day and be well.